the back, do let me know. Thank you all for coming. I understand you're during exams, so this represents a special effort. So I appreciate your time out of the afternoon, and thanks to Emma for the invitation. This is a paper that I initially wrote as part of a panel on the social life of prayer. So what I'm trying to use here is, that was sort of the theme that got me into this. Basically what I found during my fieldwork, so I've worked with Pentecostals in urban Zambia since 2003, and what I found during fieldwork is that most of the thing that people spent more time doing when they got together than anything else was praying. And for a long time, my field notes would just say 1 hour of prayer, partly because as you'll get through here, it's really hard to figure out exactly what any one particular person is doing. But I would sort of find it kind of a chore to sit through this long period of prayer that I couldn't really understand what was going on, and it seemed to go on forever and ever. And then one day it dawned on me that this was the thing they were doing more than anything else, and I should probably try to understand it a little bit better. So this is one attempt to do that, so I'll be really interested to hear what any feedback people have. So I'm going to start with a quote from Marcel Mauss's essay on prayer, which is his unpublished or recently published in English, I just think in like 2003, doctoral dissertation. It says, "A prayer is not just the effusion of a soul, a cry which expresses a feeling. It's a fragment of a religion. In it, one can hear the echo of numberless phrases. It is a tiny piece of literature. It is the product of the accumulated efforts of men and women over generations." So, Vanachanda, so here I'm using Vana to indicate a technonym, so which is very common in Zambia, as in most of Southern Africa, people are called by the names of their children. So here, Vanachanda is Chanda's mother. Vanachanda often brought her young son Tim with her to prayer meetings at Higher Calling, a Pentecostal fellowship on the Zambian Copperbelt where she was a regular attendee. Tim was notably patient with the long stretches of prayer, sitting quietly on a wooden bench while all around him believers shouted, clapped their hands, and paced the room. However, Tim told his mother that he would not sit anywhere near Gwen, as he found her prayers too frightening. In this opinion, Tim was not alone. While Pentecostals are not usually uncomfortable with ecstatic demonstrations during religious services, there was something about Gwen's prayers that made many people at Higher Calling uneasy. When Gwen prayed, she would shake and shudder, keening and lurching forward in her seat. Sometimes she would fall to her knees, arms and voice raised high. Vanachanda shared her son's fear of Gwen with me during a longer conversation about why she felt that Gwen should not be allowed to come to Higher Calling meetings, or at the very least, that she should be kept under more careful control. In her outline of the problems with Gwen's prayers, Vanachanda included what we will see was a rather surprising addition. According to Vanachanda, Gwen's characteristic shudder was something that she had copied from Vana Rachel, an erstwhile leader at Higher Calling who, it was true, used to shudder and shake in prayer in a way that was very similar to Gwen. Now, at first glance, Vanachanda's comments appear to echo the well-documented Protestant concern shared by charismatic and Pentecostal Christians with the importance of sincerity in religious practice. However, while there's no doubt that authenticity has historically been a central concern for many Christians, I want to argue that something else is going on in Vanachanda's critique of Gwen. To wit, what upset Vanachanda about Gwen's prayer was not the possibility that it was not authentic or sincere, but rather that her prayers were symbolic of the serious problems that Higher Calling was facing as a congregation. In order to make this claim, my focus in the following analysis will be on the role of prayer in the formation and composition of the Pentecostal person. As we will see, praying, and praying in a particular way, is a central aspect of being a Pentecostal on the Copper Belt. The process through which people develop their abilities in this type of prayer forms them into Pentecostal believers. It also makes them into iconic representations of their religious communities. My analysis in this paper contributes to the growing literature on Pentecostal personhood, and more specifically to the question of whether we can speak of a Pentecostal believer as a bounded or a permeable subject, as an individual or a individual, to take up the language more common in anthropology that's sometimes used here. So I'll begin my discussion with a brief outline of the literature on Pentecostal personhood before turning my attention to Pentecostal prayer on the Copper Belt, first through a more general description and subsequently by exploring how new members of Pentecostal churches learn to pray. What emerges from this ethnographic discussion is a particular model of the person. On one level, prayer in Pentecostal churches reflects those studies of Protestant prayer that have connected direct communication with God to a bounded, individualized self. However, in the particular context of the Copperbelt, this aspect of Pentecostal prayer is made to depend on a kind of permeability, on the capacity of believers to absorb the words of their religious communities. It is in the light of this analysis of Pentecostal prayer that we can understand the problems that Gwen presented to members of Higher Calling, and I'll conclude by returning to her story. My argument in this paper turns on a practice that I call collective personal prayer, which is the label I'm trying to sort of promote or trademark or something. A feature of Pentecostal ritual life throughout the world, I've heard this referred to as Korean-style prayer, which is not a term that I was familiar with, but several people have given this to me as an example. It's a feature of Pentecostal ritual life throughout the world. This practice is exactly what it sounds like. Everyone gathered prays out loud at the same time. The result is a cacophony of petitions that, on the Copperbelt, includes various Zambian languages, as well as English and occasionally glossolalia. My informants are kind of unique as Pentecostals in that most of them don't speak in tongues, and in fact, a lot of them find that concept really frightening. So that's not a sort of defining characteristic of Pentecostalism on the Copperbelt for most people. Believers engage in collective personal prayer during spontaneous gatherings with friends and when praying together with their families. Collective personal prayer is also the most important part of formal ritual life. When Copperbelt Pentecostals gather for worship, whether for Sunday morning services or Bible study meetings in another believer's home, more time is devoted to this type of prayer than to any other activity, except perhaps the sermon. Collective personal prayer has a sound all its own. Walking through Nsofu, the neighborhood where I carried out my fieldwork, one can tell immediately if there's a Pentecostal meeting in a particular house, as the staccato echo of clapping hands and blended voices floats out to the street through windows opened against the heat. Apart from its distinctive oral qualities, the other crucial feature of collective personal prayer is that it takes place over long stretches of time, and it's not unusual for believers to pray in this way for an hour or more during a Pentecostal meeting. As we'll see, this requires considerable stamina. I'll return to a discussion of Copperbelt Pentecostal prayer in a moment. First, however, allow me to briefly examine the literature on prayer and personhood, which will inform the analysis that follows. So one cannot engage in discussion of Pentecostal personhood without addressing the question of individualism. In the light of the history of social scientific discussions of the person, this is no surprise. Scholars have long associated the rise of the Western individual, the independent, autonomous, and thus essentially non-social moral being, in Louis Dumas' fine phrasing, with the development of Christianity and especially Protestantism. This was certainly the case for Dumas' teacher, Marcel Mauss. In his last published essay, Mauss argued that the modern idea of the person was in large part indebted to Christian moral categories. These distinctions were refined in the Protestant tradition, which emphasized individual communication with God, further delimiting the person as a bounded entity. This argument echoes some of the concerns of Mauss's unfinished doctoral dissertation, his essay on prayer, which traces the development of prayer alongside the evolution of religion. As religion moved from mechanical to spiritual, Mauss argued, prayer also moved from collective to individualistic. By hitting on prayer as a particularly important aspect, particularly important to the creation of the Protestant person, Mauss anticipated one of the most fruitful lines of analysis in the anthropology of Christianity by a century. Because God can see inside a person, can apprehend all her desires and feelings and intentions, prayer demands a particular kind of speaking subject. Namely, one who is sincere, whose internal sentiments and external expressions match up perfectly. Here, the notion of the Christian person as defined by her thoughts and feelings, as an individual who is bounded and distinct from others, emerges especially clearly. Faced with the demands of a sincere speaking subject, the close correlation between Christian adherence and individualism cannot be denied. Alongside these observations, however, anthropologists have also increasingly emphasized the permeability of the Christian person. Turning our attention to Africa in particular, discussions of permeability have largely been divided between two primary concerns. The first of these is the vulnerability of the individual believer to malevolent spirits. Ancestors, jealous neighbors, or past lovers may easily bring a curse on a believer, perhaps because she has neglected her obligations to her family, perhaps because she has become too successful. It is in the light of these dangerous social connections that deliverance from demons, which is what's happening here, The Osama bin Laden t-shirt definitely was part of the problem, I was told. Deliverance from demons occupies such a prominent position in Pentecostal practice. Deliverance also points to a second way in which African believers can be described as permeable persons, namely in their dependence on powerful church leaders. Here, one of the most striking examples comes from Richard Werbner's discussion of charismatic healers in Botswana, whose skill is derived in large part from their ability to enter into another person's suffering, to take pain into their own bodies in an effort to divine its source. Identification with religious leaders through this kind of consubstantiality is therefore key to freedom from the various ailments that follow from consubstantiality with evil spirits. In reality, of course, Pentecostal personhood is neither completely individualist nor completely individualist, but is instead characterized by a complex interplay between boundedness and permeability. It is in the light of this observation that Girish Jaswani urges scholars to give more attention to the different ways in which the Christian self emerges relationally. This is precisely what I aim to do in this paper. In particular, what I want to show is that by learning to pray the Pentecostal way, new believers are incorporated into a shared mode of religious practice that both forms and defines them as Pentecostals. The model of personhood that emerges from an analysis of this kind of prayer is one in which an individual believer does not cease to exist as a bounded, recognizable entity, a fact that will become especially important in the conclusion. Prayer is still individualized, a conversation between a believer and God, and even when this is done out loud, in public, as in the context of collective personal prayer, it includes things that are meant for God alone to hear. That being said, while individual believers are not eclipsed by the relationships in which religious participation embeds them, we will see that their identity as Pentecostals is in large part constituted by their ability to mobilize the linguistic resources of their community in prayer. As such, we can say that they're not only bounded, but also composite persons whose religious practice comes to reflect a wider network of believers, thereby turning them into icons of their religious communities. This section is called Where Do You Pray? On the Copper Belt, the Bembo verb to pray, which is gupepa, is often used as a shorthand term for religious membership. So, for instance, someone might indicate that she was a Catholic by saying, I pray at the Catholic Church, and this is common, I know, in other African contexts as well. Similarly, when asking where a person goes to church, one asks literally, where do you pray? While I do not want to make too much of this linguistic convention, it's worth pointing out that Pentecostals have expanded this particular usage. Among believers, the language of prayer is used to denote not only religious affiliation, but religious adherence as well. So, for example, when a person says, I could never stop praying, she means she could never leave Pentecostal practice behind. Likewise, when wanting to communicate that someone is a committed believer, a Pentecostal may simply say, he prays. In the popular shorthand, then, prayer has come to express Pentecostal identity, and for Copper Belt believers, prayer is central to, perhaps even metonymic of, religious life. Although Pentecostals do not deny that God can hear someone who prays in his heart, as they say, this is not the way that my informants generally pray. During my fieldwork, I lived in the home of a Pentecostal leader who I refer to as Pastor Mwanza. He and his wife, who had also trained as a pastor, oversaw an Nsofu congregation that I call Key of David. While eating dinner one evening, Mrs. Mwanza remarked that lately she had noticed a difference in the way that she was inclined to pray. These days, she said, I just feel like praying like this, and she went quiet like this and bowed her head. Her husband took one look at his wife's proposed prayer posture and quickly responded, then you have stopped being a Pentecostal. Clearly, in the eyes of this church leader, audible prayer was essential to what it meant to be a believer. Pastor Mwanza practiced what he preached, and I grew accustomed to hearing him and his wife praying in their room each morning, the steady hum of their voices floating down the corridor of our house, blending together as the couple formed the smallest possible unit of collective personal prayer. In the above discussion, we've so far identified two key features of Pentecostal practice on the Copper Belt. Being Pentecostal means praying, and more specifically, praying out loud. There are certainly believers who have no qualms doing this alone. Most memorable for me in this regard was the daily practice of one of the Mwanza's neighbors, who would awaken each morning at 4:30 to pray loudly, very, very loudly, for his family, his health, and his finances. When I lived in the Copper Belt city of Chingola, I had a similar neighbor. I think everyone probably has them, actually. I've certainly always had one, whose nighttime battles with the powers of darkness had a large audience in our apartment complex. While there are some believers who are obviously not bothered by the prospect of praying out loud when they're by themselves, most of my informants said that they found it difficult to pray alone, and that they preferred to pray at Pentecostal gatherings. Part of the problem was that when they were at home, they felt they were easily sidetracked by housework or visitors. In contrast, believers described formal ritual contexts as spaces that allowed for long stretches of prayer without distraction. And my informants are particularly fond, as again, throughout Africa, this you find this, of overnight prayer meetings or all-night prayer meetings. I think that's true for lots of reasons. It's an opportunity, especially for women, to be outside of the house at night, which is generally not something that they're able or allowed to do. It's a time, it's an ascetic practice. It's sort of tied to a sense of ritual efficacy because nighttime is also a really dangerous time spiritually. So if you're praying during that time, your prayers are going to be especially powerful. But the way that people talked about it then was that there was just this long period of time which was devoted to prayer, and that especially long chunk of time was something they didn't normally get. That was something they really liked. What's more, collective personal prayer has the advantage of providing believers with a degree of privacy.